This week on Writers, Inc.
I get given 18 months, basically, to write a book, which sounds like quite a while. But every year I make a radio series for the BBC, which becomes a podcast. I mean, it's not a lot. It's only four episodes. But there is no, it's on a BBC budget. So there are no researchers. There are no writers. It is all just me. So that takes me a couple of months. And I'm also on tour for 3 to 4 months a year. And so of every 18 months I'm given to write a book, I only have 9. Not because I spend the rest of the time, you know, filing my nails on a chaise longue while consuming violet creams, but because I am always out doing another thing.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
J.P. Reinflesch.
Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. And happy couple days after Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, happy holidays.
Yeah. Holy hell, I had a great Christmas.
You sound like you're still celebrating.
I feel like I should be still celebrating, but yeah, I'm recovering.
Nice.
Yeah, me too. I had 3 Christmas dinners. That's gonna take some exercise.
That's the worst. So like, did you leave home and like have to go from one house to another, like that kind of
thing? Well, it was the 24th, 25th, 26th. So they were 3 days in a row. Yeah.
Sounds like the title of a rom-com. I had 3 Christmas dinners. Yeah. 3 Christmas dinners and a funeral.
And what's in the box? There was a funeral.
I think Hugh Grant has to be in it if you add that.
Yeah. Long after he's dead, they'll reanimate his moldering corpse so that he can be in these rom-coms. So.
Like Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. We had a great, so my wife started planning this Christmas dinner in like October and buying all the things for it and having them scattered around our house. And so it all culminated with her family staying with us on the Friday before Christmas and us having like a multi-course meal, opening gifts. She wanted to do a sampling of alcohol from around the world. So we did that. I was a wreck the next day. I'm still kind of recovering from it. But it's a good Christmas.
Yeah.
The bits I
Kevin
remember.
Got as far as Uruguay and he's just down for the count.
What are we on, Q? I don't know. I had no idea by the time it was done.
Did you get your eggnog, JD?
I'm still working on the eggnog. It's fun. I've been adding it to my workout smoothie, which is probably not the best thing to do.
That's counterproductive.
Because I don't like the taste of it by itself. Like it's too strong, but like it, you know, in my workout smoothie, it actually tastes pretty nice. It gives a little bit of a kick. And like I follow like a bunch of, you know, like people on just like workout videos type stuff on TikTok. And like one of them is Arnold Schwarzenegger. And like, if you ever watch this guy make his workout smoothie, it's the funniest thing. Cause he's got schnapps in there. He's got Goldschlager. He's got Jägermeister. And you know, he's obviously doing something right. Cause the guy's like coming up on 80 years old and he still looks like the Terminator. So, you know, I'm willing to follow that advice and throw a little whiskey eggnog in my smoothie and see if it works.
Yeah. That's not the raw egg drink I was expecting. So
I have a raw egg in there too.
Yeah.
Anyway, you had a funeral, didn't you? Like you sent me, you need to explain the picture.
Oh gosh. Okay. So I was at my niece's house and there was a story. So there was a reenacting of the movie 7 with my niece shaking.
What's
a
in
small
the box?
Box yelling,
what's
in
the
box?
Box?
And her dad laughed until he realized what it was. Spoiler alert. It was her dead hamster. And they were waiting to tell her.
Whoa. All right. So her hamster died and they just put it in a box.
They put it in a box. Dad thought mom did something with it. Mom thought dad did something with it. Sister cleaned up and put it in a drawer. Youngest sister found it. So we had a hamster funeral on Christmas. Dad in the garden with a spade. I did take a picture of the box, which I don't judge me. But it was funny, but awful.
They lost a dead hamster in a box in the house somewhere.
They did.
Like misplaced. The dead hamster.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Each parent thought the other one had disposed of it. Nobody had disposed of it. It was put in a drawer. So we had a funeral on Christmas Eve, buried Lily the hamster in the backyard.
Who will forever haunt that house.
This is why I hate clutter in the house. If you have clutter in the house, you lose dead hamsters. I feel
it's true. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's true.
I can trace all my dead hamsters back to being lost due to clutter. That's for sure.
Yeah, clutter is evil.
This will be in like JD's next nonfiction about cleaning.
Oh, my wife
tip
and I.
Number we, one.
Tip my wife one. And I butt heads on this all the time because like I could live in like one of those. Is it Sweden where like they have like literally nothing on the counters and it's like all clean lines and like I could totally live like that, like literally nothing on any surface. And my wife is the exact opposite. She comes into the house and like her purse gets tossed on a chair. You know, shoe ends up over here, you know, just stuff everywhere. And like our daughter is kind of a mix in between, like, you know, she picks up after herself and then she goes and yells at mom when she leaves stuff out. So I guess she's kind of leaning into my camp. But I hate clutter. Oh, we've got a picture of the dead hamster in
a box.
Don't
judge me. Nice. A picture.
Is that Pledge? That's a can of Pledge next to it?
That's a can of Pledge next to the dead hamster. That, yeah.
Were you guys going for like a Viking funeral kind of thing?
We're going to light it on fire and send it out.
That picture needs to be next year's Christmas card for your family.
That's
the picture. Yep,
that's the one.
Oh, man.
Season's greetings.
All right. Before we get into the news, I kind of stumbled into, you know, it's the end of the year and I was getting an email reminder from my accountant asking me for charity stuff. Like he wants to know what I've done for charities for the year. So because it has to be done by December 31st. So I did a new one this year and I'm going to put a link in the show notes. But I found a link through the American Library Association where you can buy books and send them to prisoners in prison. And it basically it takes you to an Amazon wish list page. So you can just pick whatever you want. You load it up in the Amazon cart and it ships it to this one particular address. But, you know, so you could probably send your own books if you wanted to do that, but they want specific books. So I'm sending them what they want. I loaded up almost $4,000 worth of coloring books and crossword puzzles and this and that and something for a guy named Chuck. Like in the note, it literally said, "This is a special order for Chuck." I have no idea who this guy is, but Merry Christmas, Chuck. You've got it. Your book is on its way.
Awesome.
So yeah, we'll put the link to that in the show notes. It's a cool way to, you know, you can spend $5 if you want to. You can load it up if you want to do that too.
Yeah.
All right, JP, what is in the news?
All right. First up in the news, indie author accused of plagiarism. So a prominent indie author who we will leave unnamed for this podcast has been accused of extensive plagiarism in their self-published works in a Reddit post. This author, who has had a significant presence in the self-publishing community, allegedly used material from other published works without attribution in their novels. Examples of alleged plagiarism includes similarities in phrases and descriptions with works by other authors and content from online sources. So I wanted to highlight this, even though I don't really want to say the author's name until we get verification here, but I wanted to highlight this because this is a lot of work that was being presented and there's a lot of evidence and it is very clear that a lot of this is plagiarism. So don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
It's been interesting to watch this unfold. Especially knowing the parties involved, and it's I'm almost speechless about it because I don't understand why this would happen. And at first I thought, well, I know this person sometimes uses ghostwriters, so I thought, well, maybe the ghostwriters did it. Well, it turned out though that like some of his first original books that I know he wrote were included in this. So yeah, I just can't get my head around it. Like why would you do it? And why would you continue to do it?
It just shocks me. Like if you plagiarize, someone will always find out. You know, I used to be a GA and you can spot this stuff, right? Like we got one in, I got one turned in by a nice person. Unfortunately it said, please click here for more info, which like spawned me to look more into it. But if you plagiarize, people will always find out, especially now with all the software that's out there.
Well, that's the thing. If you go through the Reddit post, what this person basically did is they took the first look pages from this individual's titles and kind of honed in on any sentence that just seemed a little flowery or just, you know, was where the writing just kind of stood out, and then just took that sentence, did a cut and paste into Google just to see what would come up. And, you know, obviously stumbled into other titles with that exact same sentence. And, you know, this was like three or four words chained together. I mean, this is, you know, definitely something lifted from, you know, from A and placed into B. If it's all true, like I, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording. I haven't personally gone back and looked at these sentences in this individual's books, you know, to make sure they actually exist there. You know, this could be somebody with a vendetta. There's a lot of different reasons for this kind of thing showing up. The reason I honestly wanted to talk about it, though, is because I do know people do this sort of thing, you know, and you know, you see a nice sentence or a sentence sticks, you know, you copy, you know, some people do it intentionally. They grab it and they put it in their own title. A lot of people do this subconsciously. You know, you read a book and 3 years later, you're writing something, a particular sentence just pops out of your head and you put it in there and you don't know that that sentence actually came from another book. That kind of thing happens as well. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, the AI stuff, I think also, you know, is going to be a factor in this, like moving forward, because the ARs are trained on written data, you know, so they're taking these books that are already out there and they're basically chopping them up. So like if you're using AI to write your books, there's a good chance that sentence that it just gave you, you know, came in whole or in part from something else. And like Christine just pointed out, you know, the software is coming to find this. I mean, this guy found it manually, you know, he typed it into Google and Google spit out a result. Software is coming that is going to probably do this automatically. I imagine, you know, Amazon would have something like it in place. You know, the other red flag that jumped out at me is, you know, most people don't realize this, but if you read the terms of service for Google Books, when you upload your book, you're basically giving them the right to use the text from that book in their search results. So they've got a scanned copy of your entire novel available to Google, which is why this guy was able to find this stuff in the first place. So all kinds of red flags here, you know, whether it's true or not, but just, you know, a cautionary tale I think everybody's got to watch out for.
Yeah.
Well, and just to throw this out there, don't just because the evidence looks damning doesn't mean it's telling the story you think it's telling either. And I'm not going to try to make excuses for this. I'm not going to try to say that this is what's happening, but it's just as likely that, you know, first of all, this person may be planting this stuff. Other people may be plagiarizing from this writer. I mean, things like that do happen. So we shouldn't jump to any conclusions, mm-hmm. but it does look bad. I won't sugarcoat that. It does look bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think part of it is, you know, we want to report on new and recent news. We also want to keep certain names out of it until certain bigger groups than us are able to verify this information. So this is one of those things where at the very least, you can check this out on your own. And you can learn how to not do this, how to not plagiarize, because there are plenty of examples, regardless of if they're real or not.
Yeah.
Okay, next up in the news, Lightning Source finds new areas to grow. So Lightning Source, which is a part of the Ingram Content Group, is celebrating its 25th anniversary with significant shift now increasing serving the largest traditional publishers, including the Big Five. The pandemic highlighted benefits for Lightning Source's print-on-demand capabilities, and this led to greater use by those large publishers. And now there's a new large print program, and it emphasizes this total cost benefits in digital printing and a combination with traditional methods.
Yeah, I like to see this kind of thing a lot too. You know, they're not the only one out there that's doing this. There's a few companies like Lightning Source, and they're all kind of chasing the same thing. They're becoming more efficient, you know, which allows us, you know, anybody that's doing print on demand to be able to create a book for a lower cost. You know, one of the most incredible things I've seen recently is the ability to print, you know, a book that has color pages in it. But, you know, let's say you've got a 400 page book and three of those pages are in color. You're only paying for three pages now in color, you know, rather, you know, a year ago, if you wanted to do that same thing through Lightning Source, you had to pay for the entire novel as a color print, which has made it cost prohibitive. So they're all chasing these different things. You know, if you read between the lines here too, now you've got the traditional publishers also looking at print on demand, mm-hmm. which might be the bigger story there. Yep. Because, you know, they up until now they print in bulk, you know, it's more cost effective. I mean, I can't go into numbers here, but like I'm doing it with my latest book through Simon & Schuster, and I'm seeing the kind of print cost that they get by printing in bulk, and it's insane how much cheaper it is when you do large numbers. And those large number, I mean, when I say a large number, I mean like 10,000 copies, 5,000 copies, you can still do that. But when you start getting into like 40, 50, 60,000 copies, like you're printing for next to nothing. But, you know, this, I think what this is telling me, you know, just reading between those lines, is I think they're going to take a serious look at back catalog, you know, the titles that they haven't focused on in previous years, and figure out how to light a fire under those, and print on demand, I think, is going to be their entry point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I almost feel like, or I kind of hope that with this whole print on demand approach with traditional publishers, that certain companies will start to quote unquote legitimize the print on demand approach. And the reason I say that is, you know, reaching out to Barnes and Noble, for example, a local one, and just having a couple local author books, we all have print on demand settings on Ingram. And so we get immediately denied. And so there's a lot of loops to kind of get through to see if there's a different way to get those books in there. And it's literally the only reason they said was it's the print on demand setting. And so we could easily switch it, but there's a big hit that a lot of people in this area just can't do. So hopefully there's maybe something good that comes out of that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the big five using indie techniques. And this next we're going to talk about too. Do you think that has any effect on contracts? Because sometimes there's out when things are out of print, you know, in the contract. So is this going to change author contracts at all, do you think?
That's interesting.
I think it probably will, yeah, because you know, they've kind of fallen back on ebooks as their, you know, catch all. You know, well, it's not out of print, the ebook is still available. Yeah. You know, so language is, you know, at least in my contracts, I have language now that specifically says out of print, you know, from the print side, ebooks, like everything is separated to kind of make that distinction. So yeah, this could keep that alive. You know, the one thing I see coming out of this that is probably a good thing is just it's going to really cut back on waste. Because, you know, the way the process currently works is, you know, you print, you know, for a traditionally published book, let's say 30, 40, 50,000 copies, whatever their initial print run is, those get shipped out to all the stores. And then 3-4 weeks after that book comes out, whatever hasn't actually sold, a good chunk of those get returned to the publisher. Most of those are destroyed. You know, they purposely rip the cover off the book or they punch a hole in it to make sure that it's not resold. Like they specifically don't want to resell it, which I don't understand. You know, because there's a secondary market. They could put them out at other bookstores. There's other ways to get rid of those. But instead, they either end up in a landfill or, you know, some might get actually recycled. But I think that's a much smaller percentage than what they let on. I think this is going to tighten that up, too, if it becomes the norm, because there is no reason, you know, for that kind of waste to go through the expense and the time of creating all of those if we can get around it. And I think this will help drive that cost down and make it efficient.
All right. Next in the news, I'm going to probably mispronounce his name, but Peich touts new marketing efforts in a letter to authors. So Hachette is enhancing its marketing strategies, including direct to customer sales via its website, aiming to foster stronger connections between authors and readers. The You Are a Bookseller campaign focuses on digital retail, where over half of Hachette Book Group's sales occur using new tools to improve online book presentation and drive those sales. So there's a lot of optimism for the growth of digital audiobook sales, especially with that Spotify entering into the market. And Hachette is actively combating book bans and promoting those diversity, hopefully through this sort of new approach.
By the way, Google says this is pronounced Peach.
Peach?
Really?
Thank you.
Peach. Yeah.
All right. But it's interesting to me to see that even the big five are moving to direct sales. So
I know.
With this one and the leading source, I'm like, what is going to be the difference between TradPub and IndiePub in the future?
I've been arguing for the past couple of years that there is no difference at this point. Like, it's just, you know, you have slightly different paths and the way things work on front end and back end. But for the most part, the methods are all the same at this point. The lines are blurry.
I think one of the things that is also happening here, and like if you go to your favorite author's website, take a real close look at who actually created that website for them, because a lot of the big name authors don't actually own their own website. Their publisher actually creates it. So what this is allowing them to do as Hachette or as, you know, Penguin Random House, as whoever, is to go out there and create an online store, a presence for that author, because they're basically going to say, well, we're handling your website. We'll go ahead and set up the print on demand section for you. This is going to increase your sales. You know, it's a good thing for you, but you know, they're going to be collecting a larger percentage of that revenue because they're setting up the whole deal. So I think this is them kind of getting a foothold into that world. But yeah, it is interesting to see just the, you know, again, the shrinking planet, you know, like people are, you know, everybody's gravitating towards, you know, on demand. I think over the next couple of years, I think we're going to see a lot more of it. I don't think things like Amazon are going to go away because that convenience factor is, you know, the reason they exist in the first place. And I can't see it ever becoming more convenient to go to an author's website to buy a book than, you know, to buy it direct from Amazon if you're already there buying other things. But where you are going to see this pick up, you know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, when you're on Facebook, you know, there's going to be a direct buy button and you're going to be able to buy that book directly on Facebook without leaving the platform. And that's going to be done through the author's own setup. So yeah, interesting time.
Yeah, I set that up recently, hooking up my own merch store to Facebook. And so they kind of communicate to each other. You just tag your photo with whatever product it is, and they can buy it right off of Amazon without leaving it. And it's really handy.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, the only one I've had a trouble with so far is TikTok, because they can't set up a pre-order, not direct. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you reroute to Amazon or something, you can get away with it, but they don't have the ability to collect pre-orders yet. But I'm sure that's coming.
Yeah. We have an update. Last week, we talked about the Tolkien estate, and this week they won the court order to destroy the fans' Lord of the Rings sequel. So California judge ruled that Demetrius Polycron's unauthorized sequel to J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings violated copyright protections. Therefore, Polycron is barred from distributing that book and must destroy all copies.
Well, now I want one.
It'd be worse than that now, right?
Yeah, I've got a whole shelf of rare books. I want to put this one up there. That's again, this guy should have never done it in the first place, but just imagine having to sit there and, you know, put all your books on a big pile and light a match, because that's essentially what they're telling him to do.
I'll send him
but
some
the
pledge.
Stones on this guy, though, like the because it wasn't just, correct me if I'm remembering this wrong, but it wasn't just that he wrote a book that was violating the copyright of the Tolkien estate. He also sued them and Amazon and others, right?
Mm-hmm.
He did. Yeah, this started. This guy.
I mean, come on, that guy. that's a hell of a name too. Demetrius Polycron sounds like somebody who would have the cojones to do exactly this sort of thing.
I'm gonna put this guy in a coffee mug and a t-shirt. He's my new hero.
This episode is brought to you by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. AutoCrit takes you far above standard grammar checking or cookie-cutter guidance. Instead, it's like having an experienced editor in your genre watching over your shoulder to help you deliver great writing that keeps your audience trapped in the story. You can even compare your writing style to more than 100 best-selling authors right down to the word level, so you can see what the best in the business do to keep their storytelling clean, clear, and crisp. Listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can now take advantage of lifetime membership for one single fee. That's right, no renewal fees.
Hi, this is J.D. Barker. I've used AutoCrit for years, and not only has it improved my writing, but it's been a crucial tool with aspiring authors that I've mentored. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just beginning, it'll help you find your weak spots and weed them out. Give it a shot with your latest project. Trust me, your editor will thank you.
Head to autocrit.com/JD to get your lifetime membership. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
And on that note, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Natalie Haynes. Natalie's the author of 8 books, including 1,000 Ships, which was a national bestseller and was shortlisted for the 2020 Women's Prize for Fiction. Her latest novel is called Divine Might and releases January 2nd next year. Geez, a couple days from now. Here she is, Natalie Haynes.
So I'd like to ask about how you got started writing.
I guess I've probably always written one way or another. When I was an undergraduate, I was a stand-up comic. I was a stand-up comedian for Footlights, the comedy society at Cambridge University, which provided you with a reasonable chunk of Monty Python, with Hugh Laurie, with Emma Thompson, with John Oliver, with whom I overlapped there. And so I was writing stand-up right from my late teens. And then I sort of moved sideways a bit into writing op-ed for the London Times and then the Independent. I started writing books because I wanted to make something that was a bit less ephemeral, I guess. I wanted to write things that had a longer, I mean, I hesitate to say shelf life because it feels like a pun, but you know what I mean. I love stand-up and I still love performing. Now, but it only exists in the time that you make it, you know, that's its only existence, and that's beautiful and wonderful, but it's not sufficient for me now. So I like being able to combine books which feel like they have some longevity to them and performance which feels like it's just for that audience, just for that night. I love the combination.
Yeah. So you still do stand up then? That's something you still participate in occasionally?
I wouldn't call it stand up anymore, although other people do. I perform. I'm on kind of perpetual tour in the UK and elsewhere talking about the subjects of my book. So I'm doing a tour about goddesses, of course, at the moment. And I guess I would not call it stand-up because its primary function isn't to get a laugh. It's probably, you know, like a really funny lecture, but it looks a lot like stand-up. So I completely understand why other people call it that. And my show on the BBC here in the UK is called Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. So obviously it's a double meaning, stands up for as in defends, but also stands up for, does stand up on the subject of. And so you can again see, you know, it's recorded with a live audience. You can see why that blurring occurs, and I'm partly responsible for it. So yeah, no, I wouldn't call it stand-up because stand-up is a really tough job. But it's a really fun kind of monologue, I guess.
Nice. And so do you think that translates into your writing, like that kind of voice? Do you think it's Definitely. Maybe different than someone who doesn't have that background? I'd love to hear about that and how you think that influences your writing.
Very definitely. Certainly my nonfiction voice is pretty close to my own, and my performing voice, again, pretty close to my own. So the interesting point actually comes at the moment where I start to build the show, the live show, because I'm always doing it right down to the wire. Obviously, I do everything on time except create live shows. It's the only thing, because the moment that you kind of crystallize it is the moment that there's no way of doing it a different way. You know, it feels so devastating. So I always properly run it down. And I guess then and only then do I notice there are stories which will work in the book, but not on stage. And there are stories I'll find on stage which I could never have made work in the book. And so they do differ, but there's a huge overlap. With the fiction, it's not quite the same. The talks that I write and perform to go with the novels, obviously you don't want to kind of give away the entire novel. But also, brutally, my novels are usually quite sad. And my live shows are usually quite fun. And so generally, they have a more tangential relationship. So I might spend, as I did with the talk for Stoneblind, I spent the time talking about artistic sources for the most part of about Medusa and Gorgons and Gorgonea and so on, and responses to those artistic sources. But the actual kind of plot of the book, I spent very little time on, in fact, zero time on, because I want people to read the book as a book, and I want them to see the live show as a live show. So they relate to one another, but they aren't quite the same. And it is, you would think I would know by now, you know, what was going to work in one context and what would work in another. And I'm often wrong, even still. So, you know, there are times when you think, oh, this is just a bit too sad or too serious. And actually it provides a really beautiful kind of texture to the performance and people really go with it. And you're like, God, I would never have thought that would work. And other times where I think, oh, this is an absolute shoo-in and I can never land it. And I don't always know why, you know, I'm as experienced a performer as most, I made my living as a stand-up comic for 12 years. So you would think that I would always be on top of it, but there are still times when it surprises me. And every single show has a joke in that I don't get. And the one at the moment, I'm like, why? I don't think I can't. It will actually kind of destroy the magic if I pause to go, just explain to me now what you're laughing at, because I don't know. But it's good. I think it adds to the mystery. So yes.
Oh, that's amazing. So I believe your first book that came out was a children's novel. Is that correct?
That's right. Called The Great Escape. A title I didn't like because there is already a very famous film called The Great Escape, starring, of course, Steve McQueen, on whom all right-minded adults had a crush when they were a less right-minded young woman. And so, yeah, I was worried it would get lost because its title was impossible to search for. And I think that's pretty well what happened. It still has a few loyal readers. It has structural issues. I'll tell you that for nothing. I would write it a lot better now. But, you know, it was a way of starting. I had the idea for a story that was definitely a children's book. But I don't know if I was a sort of a natural children's writer, certainly not at the time. I did a bit of promotional work for it, and it was like, oh, I do actually quite like talking to kids, and I was sort of surprised by it. And now I have nieces, so I'm less surprised, but I spend quite a lot of time talking to children. But at the time I wrote that, which was 16 years ago, can that be true? It was published in the UK, then that wasn't part of my life yet. So yeah, I spent a lot more time after that thinking about structure and the shape of how I would write later novels. But I'm glad it exists.
Yeah.
My mom says I'm always really kind of dismissive of it because I don't think it's good enough. And perhaps she's right. But it did some things well, but other things, you have to learn by doing, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Right. That's all there is. You learn with every book. And so you did children's and then nonfiction and then adult.
Yes. I wanted to write a novel.
Yeah.
next. And there was just, it was the same time as the financial crisis happened. It was Great Escape came out in 2007. And then I wanted to write a novel. Well, I did write the manuscript for a novel in 2007-08, but I just couldn't sell it because there was absolutely no market for debut authors doing anything even remotely non-genre. So it felt to me, maybe it just wasn't a good enough book, I don't know. I have resisted the urgings of people to publish it subsequently because I think it, if it wasn't good enough when I wasn't successful, it isn't good enough now as far as I'm concerned. I wrote it and I couldn't sell it. And it was a long, very drawn out process. It was very painful. But at the same time, I had a weekly column in the newspaper and I wrote, at their behest, I wrote a column about modern politicians and which ancient politicians or characters you could sort of map them onto. And it was sort of jokey, but fun. At least that was the idea. But, you know, it was reasonably serious minded. It was like, well, this is, you know, the point of contact between this person and this person. And I had huge fun doing it. And it was just one of those pieces that ran in the letters pages for weeks afterwards with people writing in, "Dear sir, Ms. Haynes appears to believe," and you're like, "Oh, here we go." And so, you know, they kind of argued the toss with each other for quite a while. And it made it clear anyway that there was a market for that kind of book. And so I wrote a nonfiction book about largely ancient Greece and Rome and the modern world and how, you know, we can find parallels. But my heart was in writing a novel, which is what I had wanted to do, had tried to do and failed. And I hate to fail, you know, long term. I don't mind in the short term. That's fair enough. That just proves you were trying.
Yeah.
But yeah, long term, it doesn't suit me. So once Ancient Guide was out, I went back to writing fiction. So I published The Amber Fury in the UK in 2014. It was called The Furies when it came out in the US. But unless you personally know my mum, I'm pretty sure you haven't got a copy. And then Children of Jocasta, and then Ships. And having written three quite harrowing novels in a row, they are different kinds of harrowing, but they are, to their author anyway, they were all pretty, they contain pretty traumatic imagined things. I sort of felt like I needed to recover. And so I wrote Pandora's Jar basically that's my recovery, is that I get to go and look at brilliant, cool things in the ancient world and then tell you about them, but I don't have to imagine them from the inside, which is where the difficulty arises in terms of equanimity. And so at that point, I was really, really fragile after doing Ships. And it seems very strange now because it changed my life. You know, Ships was the book that smashed through all the barriers that were in front of me, or that it felt that were in front of me. And it was a big success in the States. It was a big success in the UK. It was shortlisted for the Women's Prize. So it really did change the way people looked at me. And certainly it changed the crucially numbers of people who bought my books. But I had to recover from it, melodramatic as I know that sounds. And so Pandora was the way of doing that. And then I said from then on, I would alternate novel and nonfiction so that I would, I miss being inside other people's minds when I'm only writing nonfiction. And I'm really ready now, having done Divine Might last year into this year, to write another novel. I've really missed it. But I have to alternate them, otherwise I just go crazy.
So what is that process like for you, alternating between fiction and nonfiction? Do you just work at one at a time, or
yes,
you kind of, you, so your single project?
I wish I were, but every year, I get given 18 months basically to write a book, which sounds like quite a while, but every year I make a radio series for the BBC, which becomes a podcast. And that takes, I mean, it's not a lot. It's only four episodes. So it's short, although next year will be eight episodes. But there is no, it's on a BBC budget. So there are no researchers, there are no writers. It is all just me doing all of it. So it is tough. It's really tough getting it all done. So that takes me a couple of months. Next year, I guess I probably need to set aside longer, probably 3.5 months, something like that. And I'm also on tour for 3 to 4 months a year. So I basically have 6 months in every 12 to work on a book. And so of every 18 months I'm given to write a book, I only have 9.
Wow.
Not because I spend the rest of the time, you know, filing my nails on a chaise longue while consuming violet creams, but because I am always out doing another thing. So it's never one project, actually. It's always, you know, one book, yes, but additionally the radio series or the live tour or all of the above. So it's pretty frantic, but it's okay.
Yeah, that's a lot to juggle. So
I'm curious, like, how you're writing now. And when you started with your first nonfiction and fiction book, what type of job were you working? Another job then? Were you doing, I know you said you were doing columns. What else were you kind of doing at that time?
Yeah, that was pretty well it. I was just, I just sort of left doing stand-up, which I had done for a long time. And it's a tough life, you know, it's a lot of travel. And it's very gladiatorial. And I loved it. And I don't miss it. And so I was finishing that up when I wrote Ancient Guide, I guess, and writing. I wrote one or two columns a week. I did a lot of arts reviewing. So I reviewed for the BBC on radio and on TV, and I reviewed for The Guardian. I reviewed for The Indie and various magazines. Also, as a film reviewer for the Reader's Digest. So I was reviewing about 100 films a year. At that time. Now I could easily, you know, see 10 films in a year and that'd be it. I'm always out on tour. It's like, how did that happen? But just, you know, I guess these are just different times in your life. So I reviewed a lot of theatre, a lot of film, and a lot of art, which I still love writing about now. And you can, I think you can feel all those influences through my nonfiction and Divine Might. I think you can really tell this is somebody who loves talking about visual arts, who loves talking about cinema. I'm so happy. It's such a happy place for me to be writing about, you know, something like The Hunger Games, both on screen and, you know, in its books. And simultaneously, I'm just delighted being able to tell you about, you know, this really battered sculpture of a goddess that, you know, is thousands of years old, and why it's important, even though it looks like it's just, you know, a bashed up bit of marble, why it's not and why it's more than that. So it's sort of strange. I didn't set out when I was doing all these things to have a kind of higher purpose. You know, as far as I was concerned, I just paid the bills by reviewing and it was fun. But it turned out to be fantastically useful for the nonfiction that I write now. And actually also it's true with Stoneblind, and you'd think I would have noticed this sooner than I did. But when I wrote Pandora's Jar, the chapter on Medusa there is what started me on writing the novel. And I just, you know, I'd literally written the chapter. It's 10,000 words long, 9,000 words long. You'd think I would have registered how very little literary evidence there was. And I simply had not. I'd literally written the chapter. And then when I sat down to write the novel, and in my defense, I was, you know, I was pretty sick with long COVID stuff at the time, but I don't know why it just hadn't entered my mind. But yeah, I sat down and I was like, okay, here we go. Let's start. And I was like, well, wait, there isn't anything. Well, when I get to this bit, no, hang on, there's not much here. And so the majority of Stone Blind is inspired by visual arts, by sculpture, and especially by vase paintings. Far more than the literary sources. I mean, Ships is such a literary book, you know, it's in dialogue with, you know, Homer, with Euripides, with Ovid in particular, those three, but with multiple other sources and resources. And then, you know, Stoneblind comes along and it's in dialogue, as I say, with a temple pediment.
Well, that's really interesting.
Right.
Yeah. So you followed more like the classics with Ships, and with Stoneblind, you had to make it up. So which one do you prefer? Do you like finding that wiggle room to reinterpret classics?
Yeah, or? I mean, both. They have really, really different. They were very different writing processes for me. As I say, partly because I was very sick when I wrote Stoneblind. You know, there are some crippling headaches in Stoneblind, and they are mine. You know, they are my symptoms of. And at one point, I think it's Zeus says something I said to my own doctor, you know, when he's asked to describe the pain of the headache. He says it feels as though my brain were at war with my skull, and that was me. I said that to my daughter, who, to be fair to him, went right. So, yeah, no, that's fine. So it was a very different process from Ships. Ships was a really intense interaction with all these books and poems, particularly and plays that I'd been reading for decades, and then Stoneblind was a much more visual. You know, at one point we were in lockdown and Europe was in lockdown. And we had just officially left the EU. So we just imposed loads of trade barriers for no purpose at all. And I desperately needed photographs of a gigantic sculpture in Berlin. And I knew I couldn't get to Berlin because there were travel bans. I knew I couldn't get into the museum anyway because it was closed. And I ordered a book on this sculpture that was only available in German, thinking there was no way I would ever see it. Because, you know, the newspapers here were full of stories of, you know, perfectly innocent small traders who were suddenly losing things for months at a time, you know, when they you could walk the damn thing from here to there and the time it was taking to get here. And the book turned up like 24 hours later. You're just like, oh my God, German efficiency is so
much. Wow.
So it was a much more visual process, which was really different for me. I think when I started writing fiction particularly, I could easily go through an entire scene without mentioning what anything looked like. You know, I was so focused on emotion and dialogue. And now I've kind of grown into it. You know, now I really enjoy it. And I spend loads of time telling you the, you know, the visual parts of a scene, but I didn't used to. I've learned how to.
Nice. So you're pulling from the classics, you're pulling from visual arts. What about more contemporary authors? Are there anyone that you studied whose techniques you like that you've brought to your own work?
I always feel like a big nerd saying it, but the person who set me on track to write classics retellings the way that I do is Jorge Luis Borges.
Oh, yeah.
Because although I do accept that he's dead, and but by the standards of classicists, he's very modern.
Right.
That's what you have to understand. Most of my guys have been dead for 2,000 years. So only being dead for a few decades is basically contemporary, as far as I'm concerned. But there's an incredible Borges story called The House of Asterion, which is very, very short, and I am about to ruin it. So please, if you're listening, stop listening for the next like 3 minutes and go and read it and then come back, because I honestly wouldn't deprive you of the joy of reading this story for the first time. But here goes, spoiler, spoiler, spoiler. It's a very short story, and it's the POV of a creature who is obviously terrified, in a dark space, lonely, hungry, desperate, wretched. And he feels that someone is coming, and he's hoping they're going to sort of save him. And then at the very end, it switches perspective. And Theseus comes out of the labyrinth. We realize that Asterion, of course, is the Minotaur, his real name, Asterion. And Theseus comes out of the labyrinth and he says, you know, would you believe it, Ariadne? He didn't even put up a fight. And it's like, oh, you know, the thing that we've been made to think of as a monster is a creature with feelings and really complex feelings. And we've just, you know, completely ignored that. And that absolute switch, I tipped my hat to it in 1,000 Ships, and only one person who's interviewed me has ever noticed that it happened. But at the end of the scene where Penthesilea fights Achilles, the Amazon warrior queen fights Achilles, the great Greek warrior, and he kills her, at the very end of that scene, it's the only time in the whole book, in fact, it's a rash claim, but it may be true, it's one of the only times, it may be the only time in my books, that you ever get a man's perspective. It flips at the end of that chapter to Achilles and examines it from his POV, and it's my way of tipping my hat to that Borges story, which switches at the end of that scene to Theseus.
Yeah.
So it was really Borges who made me see both that you could put worlds into a few pages, something I think he is absolutely incomparable at, but that you could recalibrate a story, not just as I routinely do along the lines of gender, but also a question that came up throughout Stoneblind is what makes a monster? And as far as I was concerned, Gorgons weren't monsters. They're still not monsters. Anything that has the power to kill you by looking at you and doesn't isn't a monster. It's something making a tremendous effort not to injure. And I was literally literally in the middle of writing the Medusa chapter, rather, in Pandora's Jar, when I realized there was no casualty list for when she's alive. The casualty list for after she's been killed and her head is used by Perseus as a weapon of mass destruction is tremendous, mm-hmm. An island of people at a time. But named casualties, or unnamed even, from when she has agency, there is none in any source that I could find. So I started Stoneblind thinking, well, if you have this incredible power and you don't kill or even injure anyone with it, you must be really the opposite of a monster, and the person who then turns you into a destructive force, that person is probably the monster. And so that was really the feeling that I was going for with that book. But it really does all stem back to the moment when, aged about 21 or 22, I read The House of Asterion and thought, oh my God, you know, I've been looking at this the wrong way around. There aren't that many times, I think, in your life where you can say, thanks to this piece of art, I will never be the same again. But it's happened to me a handful of times, and it was true each time. When I felt it, it was accurate, that feeling.
I love that. And Borges is a beautiful writer. For anyone who has not read him, please do yourself a favor. Go read him.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. There are worlds packed into sentences in a way that it's impossible to. They carry so much weight, and they look so slender. And I'm still dazzled by him, even after all these years.
Yeah. And I love that it kind of shift your perspective on how myths might be reinterpreted. So I want to talk a little bit about your new book, Divine Might.
Yes.
It is a female-centered look at Olympus and the Furies. It's highlighting the goddesses whose passion, power rivals that of their male kin, often in explosive fashion.
Yes.
So you're taking from the philosopher Xenophanes. Hopefully I said that right.
Yes.
So you describe his postulate that we create gods that reflect us and we see ourselves.
Yes, we do, according to him. Yeah, he says that if lion and oxen and horses had hands and could draw, their gods would look like lion and oxen and horses. And so the question that I posed in the introduction to Divine Might is, okay, because he's really specific, Xenophanes. He doesn't use, there are two Greek words which we often translate as men or man. Anthropos, which means man as opposed to god or animal, and aner, which means man as opposed to woman. And he specifically uses Andres, aner, the men rather than women, as opposed to men rather than gods or animals. People, I suppose, is probably more accurate. But anyway. And so it's a really interesting point. He doesn't say if people, if lions had hands and could draw like people do, their gods would, he says it's like men do. And I thought, well, then the question is, what would gods look like if women drew them? How would they be? And I sort of have a little wander around comic books, because it felt to me like that when it began was such a male-dominated industry. And obviously the early characters that we know of, the early superhero characters that we know, like Batman and Superman. It's like, well, what happens when women enter the picture? What happens when Wonder Woman arrives? And of course, it was very easy to find lots of examples of people sort of treating her as somebody who should be sexy, mm-hmm. Or pretty before she should be powerful. Mm-hmm. And while you might consider, and certainly I have considered either Superman or Batman to be sexy, that's not their, you know, USP. That's not the first thing. The first thing is they're super. And before everyone writes in, I do understand that Batman doesn't have superpowers. He's just got a credit card. Thank you. It's fine.
He has a Batmobile, though. So, you know, mix up.
He does. Yeah, he's got gadgets. He's paid for it. Yeah. So fair do. So I kind of thought, well, okay, what happens? How do those characters change? What happens when women imagine gods or goddesses? What would that look like? What would that be? And then in the body of the book, I tried to ask and answer those questions for different goddesses. You know, when we have muses in ancient poetry in particular and art, they tend to have a collaborative role. If anything, they have a superior collaborative role. You know, Homer's great poems both begin with an appeal to the muses. Sing, goddess of the wrath of Achilles, tell me, muse, about this turned about man, Odysseus. Homer's really aware that if the muse doesn't inspire him, Calliope, the muse of epic poetry, or no, so people like to say Calliope, he doesn't have a poem at all, you know? So he's really got to get her on board. And then by the 20th century, of course, a muse basically just means a pretty woman who Picasso likes to paint. And it's like, well, that is quite a downgrade in terms of creativity. You know, being beautiful is something the muses always have going for them. But having creative agency is something that they simply shed through time. And it's like, well, why is that? You know, why does that happen? Why are male poets in the 18th, 19th century still appealing to muses to help them out? What does it say about the poem? What does it say about the poet that you're taking your work seriously, that you're taking yourself seriously? I think so. But what does it say about the muses, and what does it say about the way that we look at the world? How we imagine goddesses in different eras says as much about that era as it does about the goddess. So I felt like it was really interesting and important to ask those questions. And sometimes it took me to somewhere really, you know, unexpected and fun. So I guess Artemis is the obvious example. You know, she's routinely shown as an archer in ancient art. And the idea of the female archer is still incredibly popular, not just because of Hunger Games, but basically because of Hunger Games. Katniss Everdeen is absolutely following that sort of, you know, the tropes that we attach to Artemis when we read about her in Greek and in Roman tellings, which is Diana usually, that she belongs in the woods or the trackless places, that she, you know, is queen of wild creatures, that she will kill them, as hunt them and kill them as Katniss has to survive. Obviously, Artemis doesn't have to survive. She's a goddess. She'll survive anyway. But this is her area, and it's so similar. And then, you know, again, there was the Marvel show following Kate Bishop taking on the role of being Hawkeye. And I was like, well, that is great. You know, this is why is it we're so interested in seeing women with these kind of incredible sharpshooter skills? You know, where does it come from? Why might it be interesting? So, yeah, I never know really at the start of a chapter. I usually have an idea of what ancient sources I'm going to look at, but I'm never really that certain of which, you know, there'll be some guaranteed things. I'm like, I can't wait to write about this modern thing. But there are other things where they just unfold as I go along. And you're like, oh my God, how did I not realize I was going to be writing about this? And then it appears and you're like, great.
Yeah. So in all your research, what do you think is different about Greek mythology where the stories of women are the focus than the men?
Different from
looking at men as the focus.
Yeah, I think probably the thing that is different about it is just that it's been in such short supply for such a long time. And it's not that it was always like that. You know, the example I always give when people ask is, we have 8 extant tragedies about the Trojan War by Euripides. 7 of them have female title characters. 7. Mm-hmm. 7 of 8 plays are named for the women in those plays. It's the opposite, I think, of what most people would assume. When Ovid writes the Heroides, so several centuries later, at the end of the first century BCE, he focuses on the women who are abandoned by their menfolk in Greek myth. I adore the Heroides. They're a really important set of poems. And it just makes you examine things that you thought you knew in a different way. So, you know, if you only read Homer, then, you know, there's a heroic exploit mm-hmm. in book 10 of the Iliad. When Odysseus goes off on a night raid, he and his friend Diomedes trap a Trojan coming the other way. They torture him, essentially. They, I think, decapitate him. And then they take the information they glean from him, and they kill King Rhesus of Thrace. They steal his horses and so on. It's a fantastically heroic, terrifying, brilliant passage in the Iliad. But when Ovid takes it on and puts it in the mouth of Penelope, Odysseus, or as Ovid considers him, Ulysses, his Roman name, when it's Penelope's perspective, waiting at home for her husband, then this, you know, tremendously brave exploit suddenly becomes an act of aggression at his loved ones. You know, she specifically says, and this is 2,000 years old, this poem. This isn't my, you know, anachronistic reading of it. She says, you know, oh, I bet you were really thinking about your wife and son when you went out and did that, because, you know, it was really dangerous. What are you doing? She's devastated. You know, Troy fell 10 years earlier. Of course, Odysseus takes 10 years to get home. And she says, you know, for me, Troy still stands. And you realize that Ovid knew 2,000 years ago that women experience war in a completely different way from men. Euripides knew even earlier in the 5th century BCE that women's experience of war was completely different. That, you know, the reason that he doesn't center any of his plays on the battlefield is because Homer did that already. The Iliad is great. We didn't need another, you know. But although obviously Quintus Manaeus also tremendous, but anyway, let's not go down that path too far. But what's dramatic for Euripides is off the battlefield. It's like in the build-up to the war. It's in the aftermath of the war. It's what happens when the soldiers decide they need to sacrifice a young girl in order to get the fair wind to sail to Troy. What happens after Troy has fallen to the women who survive? You know, the kind of action sequence stuff that happens on the battlefield is all well and good, but it has a really basic ending, which is one of these combatants will die, perhaps both, but definitely one. Whereas what happens to women after a war is lost, that is a question that you could never answer in its entirety. So he knew that this is where the real drama could be found. And his work, his output shows that. And so I think when I look at goddesses or mortal women in Pandora, and try to examine what their mythos is like, or the stories that are told about them, the temples that are built to them, the artworks that are sacred to them, the people who prayed to them, which is often women, I feel like I'm just shining a light on stuff that was there the whole time, but we were looking over here, you know, we just weren't paying attention. And in some ways, it's kind of hard to see why, you know, the temple to Athene, the Parthenon, has defined Athens' skyline for 2,500 years. You know, we recognize it as instantly as we recognize, you know, Sydney Opera House. It's like these are super recognizable skylines. So why have we spent so little time talking about Athene and what kind of goddess she is? And when we do, why am I always told, you know, I tried to buy a children's book for my niece about the goddess Athene a few weeks ago, and it just focuses on her father and not at all on her mother. And it's like, well, I put it back on the shelf, bought her a book of Roman Britain. You know, these stories are right there, and they were always right there. But I think because for a couple of hundred years of classical scholarship, you know, we didn't have very many female classicists for a long time until the sort of second half of the 20th century. There were some brilliant outliers, of course, but they were vastly outnumbered. And there are still, you know, I'm still looking at books that I own from when I was an undergraduate, which translate things in ways which they make you kind of gasp with their sexism. And you kind of, and I go back to the Greek or to the Latin, I'm like, is that in the original? And I'm looking at it, it's like, nope,
no,
that's not ancient misogyny, of which there's plenty. This is modern misogyny. This is from the 1990s or the 2000s. And it's like, I can't single-handedly strip that back. And luckily I won't have to. As I say, there are loads of brilliant people working in classics now, but I won't let it stand. Why would I?
Yeah, fantastic. And I have taken up a lot of your time. So just as we come to a close.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask you one last question. If you could offer some advice to new aspiring authors just getting started in their career, what would it be?
Well, you really need to know it. If you're going to write it, point the first. I think a lot of the time when people think they have writer's block, what they have is, I didn't do enough reading or thinking yet block. If you're really struggling with a book, a story, a short story, a piece of prose, I do see this doesn't work when you've got an essay deadline. But generally, put it aside and work on something else. You know, when your brain has done the thinking, the words are there. So do the research. And when you're editing, I know you hate it. We all hate it. But read it aloud. It's the most often given and least heeded advice a creative writing teacher friend of mine tells me, but it's always true. That's where you pick up your tics, your kind of verbal tics. It's where you pick up repetitions that you didn't intend. It's where you pick up internal rhymes that you didn't want. Read it aloud. Honestly, it is so much better to do it in your apartment on your own than it is to do it when you're reading the audiobook. You think that, oh no, I didn't want that to happen. So yeah, take it from me. This is the better time to do it. I'm saving you from yourself. And by yourself, I of course mean myself.
So I thought it was really interesting what Natalie said about not knowing when her material was going to land, even after all her experience with columns and as a comedian. What do you think about that? Have you ever had that experience?
I think she should go ahead and ask people. All right, let's pause. Tell me why that was funny. I think that's a good idea.
Perfect.
I mean, I guess that's why we use alphas and betas, right? To make sure things are coming off the way that we think they're going to come off.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I think it says a lot for her originality though, right? Like if she's not sure, I mean, I've got a lot of respect from that fact. I mean, I think if you're not wondering that and you're just putting it out there, then chances are your material's kind of blah, you know, like it, I feel like you have to put it out there and, you know, be willing to accept the fact that you're going to piss some people off and other people are going to accept it and not really know exactly how it's going to land. The stuff that makes the most noise is the best.
Can I just say, by the way, listening to this interview, she's one of those writers that makes me feel like I have not yet become a writer. That's what she makes me feel like.
Like it's holy, the accent though, right? The accent is
part of
it.
The accent, yeah. But just like her take, like the way she, I mean, I'm jumping ahead here, Christine. I don't want to get ahead of
you. Go ahead. No,
it was just, I was just really impressed by like the way she goes about like the research and the she puts thought into it, you know, and yeah, she's got her own angle that she's definitely pursuing. But I don't mind it at all. And I find it fascinating. Like she is kind of trying to mine these stories that no one else has told. And, but you know, listening to her describe everything she was doing, I'm like, man, I feel like I've never written a word in my life after this interview.
Well, if any of you guys honestly read like all the Greek tragedies and like all, you know, like that type of material, like I haven't. And
I read a lot of Bulfinch when I was younger. I have also probably forgotten most of it, as I have with most things that I've read when I was younger. So,
I mean, I had to read the Iliad and things like that in my
Odyssey
English and lit major. Yeah. So, yeah, the Odyssey and everything. But.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here. Like I read those, but like, yeah, I didn't chase any of it. And, you know, honestly, like that's the origination of a lot of the storytelling that exists today. Like we really all should be going back and looking at that. I probably don't go back far enough.
I'm going to say this. I started recently, like in the past 3 days, I came across a video on YouTube. A guy was talking about the Harvard Classics, and he had bought like the entire hard leather bound set, and he's going to read through all of them. And I'm like, that sounds interesting. So I found it on, I found like a collected version of it on Kindle. It's like 71 books for a dollar, you know? And so I started reading through those, and I have to say, like, I skipped all this stuff in like high school and stuff. Like I skipped reading the classics. I'm like, yeah, it's boring. And, I only wanted to read sci-fi and things like that. But, the more I read this stuff, the more I realize like I would have been a better writer sooner had I read and really put my brain behind this stuff. So I think that's a good practice. Go read all of Greek, you know, mythology, everything you can get your hands on.
Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting, like you said, that she shifted the focus, retelling it from the perspective of the goddesses. I think she said, we didn't need another Odyssey. Do you ever use that technique? Taking something that's known and changing the point of view.
I have. And like that really jumped out at me when she started talking about it. You know, you can take a lot of scenarios and just make a quick swap. You know, like there's tons of serial killer novels out there, but you know, the second you say, but the killer is a woman, you know, like all of a sudden that completely twists its on its head. I mean, I did it with Caller's Game. Like I got halfway through the outline for Caller's Game. It's about a radio DJ where somebody calls in and confesses to murder live on the air. And in my outline, I said, this is a, you know, Howard Stern type character. And that's kind of what I was chasing. And then at some point I decided to make that Howard Stern type character a woman. And the second I did it, like it completely changed the dynamic of the story, you know, which is a you know, really fun way to change things up. And it, you don't have to go male and female with it. I've got another book that it's currently in the pipeline. I wrote probably half the outline and the lead character was a cop that just kind of got caught up in a weird circumstance. And then I got, you know, about the midway point on the outline, I said, you know, this would be a lot more fun if I made this person a plumber. You know, so like all of a sudden, you know, because like all these skill sets that we're used to seeing from a cop, you know, like it just becomes secondary nature. But like if you make a plumber do some of these things, all of a sudden it just adds this other dynamic to it. So, you know, you've got a story that's just kind of fallen flat or just feels like it's missing something. Try doing that. You know, what happens if I change this character from A to B, you know, to see what happens with it?
Yeah, that's good advice. I've never taken an existing story. I don't think I can't think of any where and swapped the point of view or anything. But I did do kind of what JD did with, I had plotted out with as much as Kevin plots. I had an idea and wrote a treatment for a story, that was a male protagonist. But when I started writing it, within the first couple of chapters, I realized like this would be much more fun if this was a female protagonist. So I went and kind of tweaked and rewrote, kept the name because it was a gender neutral name. But that was the basis of my whole like Quake Runner series. And it ended up being a lot more fun because, you know, now I have this strong female lead and I get to tell a different kind of story than what I tell over and over again in my other books. So. Maybe I'm not qualified to tell that story, though. That's what I'm. That's what I get told.
That's a whole other podcast.
So. That's a different show.
that's all about the editing.
Yeah,
need the right editor.
Yeah, I also thought it was pretty cool that Natalie uses art to inspire her work. That's something I used to do, but I've kind of forgotten about that. Sometimes when I get stuck, I would open an art book and look at the art. Is that anything that you do?
Mm-hmm. No, that sounds a lot like procrastination to me. Let's go look at the shiny thing in the
corner.
It's
only procrastination if you stop at, I looked at the art to inspire the work. If you didn't actually write the book.
Yeah, I guess if you go back and actually finish up the book, it's okay. I try to avoid anything that just takes me away from my computer screen while I'm, I will sit there and stare at a blank screen for 2 hours before I'll get up and, Google or empty the dishwasher or do one of those other things that, kind of calls out to you when you can't find the right word. Cause I tend to, if I force myself to do it, the right word will eventually come. But everybody's different. There's plenty of times where I've talked to a lot of people where they step away, they take a week off. All of a sudden everything comes together in their head, and they sit back down and get right back to it. So everybody's different.
Neil Gaiman does something similar to what you just described. Like he has this rule. I'm going to butcher it, but he has this rule. It's like he can sit in that space, and if he doesn't write a word, that's fine. But he's not leaving until the time's up. So he's like, This is the time for this. And more times than not, he ends up doing the actual writing during that time.
The approach of looking at artwork and trying to get that inspiration or that spark reminds me a lot of how I sometimes use tarot cards as a reference to either get moving or if I'm paused for a minute. I have the easy cards that have certain words on them so that I don't even have to flip through a book. I can just flip a card, read a couple inspiration words or whatever it's supposed to mean, look at the artwork and then keep going. But that's kind of the way that I like to use artwork and or tarot for that kind of matter.
Yeah.
I'll do that in bookstores. I'll go through bookstores, when I'm not on writing time, and I'll just browse titles and covers and things. And I'm not going to plagiarize someone's work or anything. Let's just get that out of the way. But, and I don't steal their titles or anything like that, but I might pick up a book that I think is visually has a great cover, and I'll tell the story of that cover in my head. It's usually nothing at all like what they wrote. And then I've had that inspire several things, short stories and novels alike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like looking at bizarre art, try picking out some Andrew Wyeth or some Chet Czar, and you'll have some fever dreams. You'll get down on the page for sure. Cool. Well, we're running out of time. Anything else anyone wanted to touch on before we wrap up?
I said everything I came to say.
Well, that's perfect. That's what we want.
This is your last chance to talk for 2023.
So
Get it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah. This show airs on what day?
The first. This is
on Monday.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, Monday's the first. Okay.
Yeah.
Monday's the first.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year hangover, everybody.
What the hell are you doing listening to the Writers Inc. podcast on New Year's Day? Go. Get outside. Come, have some fun.
And with that, JD, who's up next week?
Oh, man. Next week, we've got Matthew Blake coming on. He's a London-based novelist and screenwriter. He's going to be here to discuss his debut thriller. It's called Anna O. This book has a really unique premise. If you haven't had a chance, just hop on the interwebs and just take a look at what the book is about. Not only is it a unique story idea, but, from an author standpoint, this one sold a lot. I believe he sold, seven figures for screen rights, for print rights in, multiple countries. This is going to be a big title. Anna O and Matthew Blake next week.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun one. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.